Blog Talk Radio.
The Eastern world, it is exploding, violence flaring, bullets loading. You're old enough to kill, but not for voting. You don't believe in war, but what's that gun you're toting? And even the Jordan River has bodies floating. But you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Don't you understand what I'm trying to say? Can't you feel the fears I'm feeling today? If the button is pushed, there's no running away. There'll be no one to save with the world in a grave. Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. So mad, feels like coagulating. I'm sitting here just contemplating. I can't twist the truth, it knows no regulation. Handful of senators don't pass legislation, and marches alone can't bring integration when human respect is disintegrating. This whole crazy world is just too frustrating. And you tell me over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. Think of all the hate there is in Red China, then take a look around to Selma, Alabama. You may leave here for 4 days in space, but when you return, it's the same old place. The pounding of the drums, the pride and disgrace. You can bury your dead, but don't leave a trace. Hate your next door neighbor, but don't forget to take rest. And tell me over and over and over and over again, my friend, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction. No, no, you don't believe we're on the eve of destruction.
Well, maybe you don't believe it. Maybe I don't either. Maybe we should. James Bostic here with you. Been a while. Last Tuesday, I think, when I had our pal Mike Cutler was with us. James Bostic here with the Conservative Perspective. Where the hell am I? On the Patriot Nation Radio Network here at blogtalkradio.com. We do it live periodically, or when we're here, it's live. Let's put it that way, or facsimile thereof. Tuesdays and Thursdays, here and there, hit and miss, kind of, sort of, at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Wednesdays, the American Allegiance program is on with author Kevin White. Terrific program there, terrific guests. He is a steely-eyed radio man if I ever saw one, and I am really happy to have him with us. And, of course, Thursdays, we have El Guapo, the handsome one himself, Mark Hoffman with Patriot Nation Radio Live. We also have a recorded version of the program that goes out on the Mojo 50 Radio Network, mojo50.com. If you aren't listening, hey, you should be. the very best in conservative and libertarian talk radio. Mojo50.com. Well, wars or rumors of such, it seems. I got to admit, I missed this one. I really, truly did not think that Putin would invade. And the reason I say that is because, honestly, after nobody got excited and there was no harumph or rhubarb when he said that he was going to recognize those easternmost provinces that butt up against Russia's southwest border, I didn't think he had to do it. I didn't think he had to invade. I think, and he was doing what he always does. This has been a bone of contention based on my extremely limited assessment of the situation. Where was I? Oh, it's given President Biden's current level of cognition, I didn't think an invasion would be necessary. I felt that all he was going to have to do is do what he has done. Again, Ukraine and Russia have had this thing going on for a few years now. And the eastern provinces of Ukraine, if you were looking at a wall or if you were looking at a clock and the center of the clock was Ukraine, from 12 o'clock to 2 o'clock, would be the provinces that would be involved in wanting to reunite with Russia. They want to separate from Ukraine. They want to go back and join Mother Russia. And there are separatists in those provinces there, those two provinces, who are probably being advised and being supplied and being assisted by Putin's government covertly. So he recognized them as whatever, independent and sovereign from the rest of Ukraine, and that would make their absorption back into Russia that much easier. He moves troops here. He moves troops over there. He shifts one armored division to this location. He moves infantry to support it. He moves logistical units around, and you know, people are watching these troop movements and they're going, what the hell is this KGB bastard doing? And he keeps them guessing. And then of course last Thursday there was an invasion of sorts. And I've seen a lot of different stuff from various people on the right with one attitude then another. I really didn't think he would invade. I didn't think he had to. I thought that he might be able to go ahead and accomplish whatever he wanted, because whatever that is, Biden's going to give it to him because he is a weak, incompetent, and feckless leader. And the people who are handling him evidently must be only slightly less weak, incompetent, and feckless. I thought that Putin would be able to get what he wanted. But now he's in there. And there are two different takes on this, and I'm going to share both of them with you. The first one comes from a fella named Colonel Douglas McGregor. And I don't even know what I logged this in as. Holy crap. I love it when I do that. And all I have here is Colonel Douglas McGregor. And I may not have even loaded it up. I bet I didn't. So here's what we'll do. We'll talk about it a little bit. We haven't seen a whole lot of really serious cattle damage. You know what I'm talking about? When we saw what was going on during Gulf War I and Gulf War II and any place else, you know, there's usually an overwhelming artillery or aerial bombardment, you know, coming from ships offshore or from carrier-based, land-based air forces or from artillery on the ground. Didn't have a whole lot of this. Didn't have much of it at all. And, well, son of a gun, doesn't look like I even downloaded the damn thing. I hate it when that happens, but it's okay. We're all cool. I do have some other good stuff, though. So this guy's on with Dan Bongino. And what McGregor said, I'll have it before you on Thursday, because I do want you to hear it. And now I'm forced to do one of those things that I hate to do, and that is to half-ass paraphrase when what he says is way more important than accurate. But essentially, what McGregor is saying, that Russia does not want to engage a civilian population, and it's making every effort to avoid civilian conflict within the population centers that they're looking at attacking. In part, this is because Putin knows that the Western approach is a propaganda war that would be fueled by what it would look like if there were a lot of massive population civilian casualties, fatalities, and injuries. What it would seem like right now, and I'm not exactly sure that this is, we're going to look at both sides of this. And this is from Colonel McGregor's perspective, and he knows a little bit about this stuff. The Western government perspective and the Western media perspective as well, is to make it seem like Volodymyr Zelensky and the people of Ukraine are beating the Russian armies because that frames a better story. However, what McGregor outlines is Putin not wanting to fuel the United Nations, NATO, and State Department narrative engineering, and thus the absence of any visible fighting. Putin will move in that direction only so long. Now, it's been a week, and there have been sanctions the world round, some good, some basically symbolic. The World Taekwondo Association stripped him of his honorary black belt. Yeah, and as a former Taekwondo student, I really feel good about that. I feel so much better and very proud. But there have been some serious financial sanctions that have been put in place. A number of banks have been sanctioned in terms of the transactions that they make globally with other nations. But the banks that were not sanctioned, and not all banks were, the State Department put out a statement saying that selected banks would be targeted for these internet sanctions. And it's a pretty safe bet that the banks that were selected for this crap aren't the ones that are dealing in the gas and oil money, which, by the way, I think we're loading up Pooty Poodle about the tune of $70 million a day for oil. Yes, you heard me right. No, I'm not making this up. Joe Biden, Big Joey, the big guy, is sending Dr. Sprinkles is giving Vladimir Putin about $70 million a day for oil. While we sit, literally, in less than 4 years, we were energy independent and we were the world's number one energy producer. We sit literally on a sea, a vast ocean of oil. From the shale deposits here in the Appalachians all the way to Alaska. Likewise, natural gas. Vast pockets of it. Millions upon millions upon millions of cubic feet of it. But Joe Biden is going to pay lip service about being some kind of serious badass when it comes to Vladimir Putin. At the same time, he's, inking out checks, stroking out checks for 70 mil a day. Now, if this is the case, and Putin has directed his military personnel, his generals, to, engage in military targets only, or as much as they can, to limit the civilian casualties and fatalities, that's only going to go on for so long. Okay? Putin is not a nice guy. He doesn't play nice guy very well, and he's getting tired of playing it. Plus, here's the thing that gets me. This is crippling his economy. Yeah, well, it's all this glow. And if there is a positive, and I'm not really sure that there are, but I guess in this case it is, if there are positives to be seen from a globalist economy, and one world order horseshit, this is something, it's happened. This is, how can I say it? It's not really a positive because it's globalism, and globalism in any of its facets is inherently evil and bad, I think. But at the same time, look how fast. It hadn't even been a week. Today's only Tuesday. And I think he made the first ground movements, Thursday. So it hadn't even been a week yet. And his economy is in really sad shape. And the Russian economy isn't that great to start out with. And this is what stupefies me. In June of 1941, Hitler sent tens of thousands of armored vehicles, of trucks, of troop carriers, aircraft, tanks, artillery pieces, about a zillion guys, and they went to invade Russia. And that was a bitter, savage, brutal, awful, terrible war. And if you heard lately, Putin spoke kind of obliquely about working to denazify Ukraine. He was looking for the denazification of Ukraine. We'll get to that in a minute. But this war took place from 1941 to 1945, April 1945, when Hitler bit a bullet and the Germans gave up. Millions of lives were lost. Hundreds of millions of lives were changed forever through injuries, through atrocities, through property damage, through physical damage. I wouldn't even be able to fathom a guess as to what the toll was, simply not just in blood and men and in material, but in treasure. Now, that went on for 4 years. That went on to both countries, well, the largest part of the world, really, was practically bled white from the war. And now we fast forward to today, and they almost make it sound like it's a waiting game. If this thing presses on for another month or so, and there's no real tangible success for Russia, what's going to happen? You can't stay. The Ukrainian government's handing out automatic weapons to the civilians, to the citizens, so that they will help the Pravda distillery. The Pravda brewery there in Ukraine has switched from distilling spirits to making Molotov cocktails, ready-made, queued up and fused, has a label on it, says Putin is a dickhead. Now, propaganda aside, and there is a large amount of propaganda on both sides here, and they're both pretty good at it. What we see overall is a very genuine desire for the Ukrainian people to defend themselves. I got a clip from, I think it was from yesterday. Her name is Victoria Spartz, and she is a Republican representative from Indiana. Let's see, T-U-V, V for Victoria. That would be, did I load it up too? Man, what in the hell? Victoria Spartz.
I thought I loaded all this stuff. What in the world?
Okay, well, anyway. Yeah, it would be in there, Victoria, V-I. Maybe I put it under Spartz, who knows? But these people are intent on protecting their homeland. They're intent. They're not, they don't want to be taken over by the Russians. They just don't want to be taken over by the Russians. And they're going to go. I mean, they're going to, representative. Okay, V for representative. That's why I was on. Anyway, listen to this. This is pretty cool.
Thank you. I didn't prepare a speech, so I'll talk from my heart. This is not a war. This is a genocide of the Ukrainian people by a crazy man who cannot get over that Ukrainian people do not want socialism, Soviet Union, communism. They want to be with the United States of America. They want to be free people. They want to be with the West. And he cannot get over. I'll tell you a personal story. I have my grandma. She's 95. She is right now in the city of Chernihiv. Actually, Chernihiv and the part of Kiev Rus studied Moscow and control Moscow. So they're bombing. They couldn't take the city. They're bombing civilians non-stop, day and night, the whole city. She has a daughter. She calls her daughter. She lives in a little village by Chernihiv. And her daughter told her they came into village with a heavy machine gun, killed almost every person in that village. And whatever people were left, women and children, they forced them to walk in front of the tanks as a human shield because they cannot take that city. So she told my mom, was shocked. She says, no, don't cry. We are not crying here. We're going to fight, but just give us some guns so we don't just fight with the sticks. This woman was born in Russia, in Far East. She's a Russian-born woman. And they're killing women and children. They do doing the bombs, vacuum bombs, carpet bombs. They are using illegal weapons. They now have special groups that trying to kill women and children tied to expect to Western Ukraine. I called my friend, and she said she was able to get out. Her friend was trying to get out. She saw a woman in the gas station get shot with her children with machine guns. So she stayed in the city. They're leveling the cities to the ground, destroying the people. They're slaughtering them like animals. They're killing the people. It is not a war. It's a genocide because we have a crazy man that believes that he has the whole world hostage. And then we have a president that talks about, and doesn't do things. You know, and what is he going to wait? When millions that die, then he's going to do more? I mean, we have not just a moral duty. We are the leaders of the free world. We want to, this is going to be the biggest genocide that ever this world experienced. And they're not asking them to fight for us, but they ask us to help, to become serious, that they have ability to defend themselves. That actually they need to understand that we're serious about this sanction. Not do a little bit here. Maybe we'll just do a little bit this oligarch. This is it. That we're serious. And I can tell you one thing. If we don't stop him there, he is not going to stop. He is going to go further. And then we'll have to send our children to die to fight this. So I think we have an obligation and duty to save this world, help Ukrainian people to survive. And this president need to get this act together and exercise some leadership. What's happening under his watch is atrocity. What he's doing to this country and to the world is unforgivable. But I think we'll get together as Republican and Democrats, but he must act decisively fast, or this blood of many millions of Ukrainians will be on his hands too. And all that oil that with blood that's flowing from Russia and gas, and we are buying that, and Europeans are buying that. It's going to be blood. It's next to this blood of the Ukrainian people. So I hope you're going to help me to send that message, because we have to be strong and we have to stop. Thank you for having me.
A little bit of backstory there on Ms. Fars. She is from Ukraine, as I'm sure you probably gathered there. There's something about this that just simply does not seem quite right. Now, having said that, I'm not a pro-war guy. I'm a pro-war guy when it needs to be. World War II being a good example. Korea being another good example. Gulf War I and II. But there's just something about this that I'm having trouble with. I'm watching the news. I'm seeing what they're showing. And maybe it's because I have this, newly jaundiced view of the news media and how they couch things, that's kind of come into being over the last 8 to 12 years that I don't look at these things. But here's the thing. Those people that were squawking, all those Chicken Littles who turned out to be right, who were squawking that, it was imminent, it's coming, it's going to be here soon. Ooh, you better watch out. And saying all these things. Yes, it did happen. But there were expectations that haven't been met here. And this, I think, this whatever this is, this invasion, this conflict, this war, that Putin thinks that he's having with Ukraine has not gone the way that people have thought it would. And the people in the media, I think, looked at it the same way that Vladimir Putin did. Russia was expected to waltz into Ukraine, and it didn't. It would appear that at this point, the Russian forces have failed in practically all of their objectives. On average, it is reported right now that right around 1,000 Russian soldiers are dying each day in this assault. So that brings us up probably, 5,000. So right around maybe 5,000 Russian soldiers, give or take, have been killed at this point. Now, if that's true, if this reporting is credible, that's twice the number of American deaths in Afghanistan over 20 years. It took us 20 years in Afghanistan to wind up losing 5,000 personnel. They've done it in 5 days. Again, if this reporting can be confirmed. And no, Kiev was never surrounded. President Volodymyr Zelensky lives. Indeed, the airport near Kiev was retaken by local Ukrainian forces. State level, they would be like reservists here in the United States. And they were reported to have retaken the airport from Russian elite troops. Now, what does this mean? What it indicates, again, if we find these reports to be verifiable, it means that the myth of Russian might has been broken, and has been broken for all time. It doesn't matter if the war isn't over. This is evident just from the last 4 days. And there aren't reserves to be thrown in, because if they had them, they would have done so already. Second, the myth that Russia poses no threat, that it's a normal country, if a bit misunderstood, that it is anything other than a primitive dictatorship, too, has been exploded. Believe it or not, this myth was held even in the higher reaches of NATO and many European countries which had never been occupied by the Russians, and that includes Germany. Germany, for the first time since World War II, is sending war material to a war zone. It voted to double its piddling 1% GDP armed forces spending, and it has suspended at this point Nord Stream 2. Even Portugal is sending war material to Ukraine. Portugal. Not to be outdone, the European Union has decided to purchase equipment to send. Thankfully, the European Union has no army, but they're going to buy stuff and send it to the Ukraine. And they should. I don't know if it's too little too late or what's going to happen with that. Russian air traffic has been removed from the European Union airspace. The central bank's reserves are being frozen. Again, yes, some of these reserves are being frozen, but I can pretty much guarantee you not the reserves that deal with oil and gas. So what's the point? Sports organizations have taken up the cudgels as well, and they're doing, that's why I said a lot of this stuff's symbolic. They're removing Russian teams from competition in various international, sports sanctioning agencies are blacklisting Russian athletes, and that's okay. What it means, for whatever reason, is that Russia is now recognized fundamentally as an international pariah because of what they've done, and I find this a bit hypocritical when all these same nations that are doing all this stuff to Russia happily went over to communist China, who right now as we speak are murdering Muslim Uyghurs in concentration camps through torture, through brutality, through slave labor. And everybody was cool with it. Everybody was cool. Thirdly, at some point, it's pretty much obvious that NATO will wind up joining the European Union and NATO, maybe both. It might be a little while, but the will of the Ukrainian people to have a normal country is undeniable. Their will to accomplish this is being forged in fire. Now, with that, Poland and Lithuania, which had been associated for hundreds of years, could form a bloc with Ukraine that is large, and they have, their neighbors, their people get along well together, Lithuanians and Poles and Ukrainians. Those three countries, not forming one single nation, but just a confederacy of nations, if you would have more people than Germany. And that would change the balance of power within the countries of Europe and of the EU as well. Now, what this means is that Ukraine, as a country, wishes to be a normal country amongst other civilized normal countries, and it's not going to accept any level of Russian dominance or influence. How could they have made, the Russians that is, how could they have made such an unbelievable miscalculation? Some smart people say primarily it's because Putin and his cronies believe their own propaganda, but that's not really it. Consider that if, God forbid, Russia had been invading Lithuania, they would have killed civilians indiscriminately. Lithuanians are not Slavs, and the Russians know that they aren't wanted there, and they hate the Lithuanians for it. But the Russians see or saw Ukrainians as part of themselves. That's why they wanted to invade. The invading Russian soldiers are given strict orders not to harm Ukrainian civilians, which proves the point. It also shows a fundamental problem in that the Russian soldier doesn't know why he's there. You see, there's no real motivation. They believe that the Ukrainians would love them, and they don't understand why the reverse is true. Some Lithuanians in Ukraine report that the Russian armed forces seem to be sleepwalking, and we're going to get to that too. All basically that Russia has accomplished in Ukraine up to this point is that ethnic Russians living in Ukraine are joining the Ukrainian armed forces, and they hate the invaders' living guts. So what's going to happen next? Excuse me. The Russians are going to lose. Again, this is just one side of the story. We've heard a lot of reasons why the Russians will. We're figuring out, you know, now we're hearing some reasons why they won't. It's run out of many types of munitions and, you know, ordnance, and it's run out of fuel. Its soldiers are not being fed, and they don't have any bullets. This is what I was talking about with the freezing of the central bank reserves, except for the money-making oil banks. Those guys are probably being left alone. So that's $70 million a day that Putin can count on. But you can't run a nation as big as Russia on $70 million a day. So with the banks that are being damaged by this, where the assets are being frozen, along with the other economic sanctions that are being taken by the West, inflation is beginning to skyrocket. It's also been reported that hundreds of tanks and armored personnel carriers, have been blown apart or abandoned on the road north of Kiev. I'm not exactly sure about that. Now, Ukraine's going to have to hold out some time longer, and it will. But what's going to happen at some point, Putin's not going to worry about bad press. If he really wants it, he's going to go get it. But again, this doesn't make sense to me because it would seem that if he was going to do this, he would have done it lightning fast from the get-go. He would have rolled in. And if these people in Ukraine, in the eastern part of Ukraine, are so pro-Russia and Russian-friendly as we have been led to believe and as the media has told us, and he's going to get in there, he's going to go do it, and they're going to help him. Where's it at? It's been 5 days. 4 days. 5 days. 5 days. Okay, in that 5 days, you've got distillery companies. You've got distilleries in Ukraine manufacturing Molotov cocktails. You've got the Ukrainian government handing out automatic weapons to the citizenry. There are no friends for the Russians in Ukraine. Beyond the cover of themselves and their combat vehicles, they have no shelter. There is no safe place in Ukraine. Now, as for joining NATO, as for joining the European Union, those, I'm not really going to speak to those things. If those are objectives that the Ukrainian government aspires to, okay, good on them. I'm not exactly sure where that's at. But none of that's going to happen if they bend the knee to the Cossack. I think we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with more on this and I guess an update on the State of the Union report, which is tonight at, I think it's at 9 o'clock. So we'll be out of here by 8:30 and give you guys plenty of time to dig into that and get ready. We will be back with more of Conservative's Perspective right after this.
surge of love began. Your touch has thrilled me like the rush of the wind, and your arms have held me safe from a rolling sea. There's always been a quiet place to harbor you and me. That flows from you. Don't let me drift away, my dear, when love can see me through. Our love is like a ship on the ocean.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Warren Zevon and The Envoy from a 1984 album of the same name. Folks, 1984, almost 40 damn years ago, ain't nothing new. What has changed from the lyrics in that song? Not a damn thing. Let's get back to Russia for a minute, and then we're going to move on because old boy's on tonight, and I got to wrap some of this crap up. Having said what we just said about Russia and what is happening in Ukraine and what would appear to be clearly Russian military forces that are not up to readiness snuff, if this reporting can be borne out. Now, let's talk about this for a minute. In the winter of 1939, Russia, having just conquered half of Poland after Germany had already knocked that country out of the war, had decided that war was good business. So they invaded Finland. In Poland, the Soviets retook land that had been under the control of Tsarist Russia for 200 years before it was divided away from Russia at the Treaty of Versailles. Repeating that strategy on November 30th, 1939, Russia attacked Finland, intending to recover land that had also been part of Tsarist Russia before Versailles. Like Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, Finland was a Baltic state that had existed for centuries before becoming a Tsarist vassal state. But unlike Poland, Finland had a strong army which had not been defeated in battle. In the Kremlin, the Soviets decided that the time was right to take that territory back, thinking it would be another piece of cake, like Poland had been 2 months earlier. Not dead air, just getting a drink. All this talking makes a fellow thirsty. Indeed, the invasion should have been a cakewalk for the Soviets. After all, the Soviets had more soldiers in their army at 1.8 million than Finland had males of all ages in its entire country in 1939. However, after two serious but little-known border wars earlier in 39 with Japan along the Manchurian-Mongolian border, many of the Red Army's best troops were still stationed along that battle line. On November 30th, the Soviet force, 450,000 men in 21 army divisions, crossed the border. Known as the Winter War, this invasion focused on the Karelian Isthmus, a strip of land that separated the Baltic Sea from Lake Ladoga. Karelia seemed to offer a highway, as it were, between Leningrad and the Finnish capital, Helsinki. Most of the invading army, a 250,000 Soviet troops, attacked along that narrow strip of land. Facing them on all fronts were just 130,000 Finnish soldiers. However, the Red Army committed two cardinal sins, both of which it would appear they are now repeating in Ukraine. They sent in an army largely made up of newly conscripted men, virtually just out of training and ill-equipped for a long war along the Arctic Circle. Then they divided their forces, sending nearly half their army, around 200,000 men, to invade central and northern Finland, territory with no strategic value to the Soviet Union. Their divided forces were then defeated in detail. Now, while some of the Red Army troops had invaded Poland in September, there was a decided and decisive difference between Poland and the attack on Finland. First, the Polish army had already been defeated by the German army, which invaded 17 days earlier. What the Russians did was less of an armed invasion and more of a peaceful occupation of an undefended territory. So while they experienced the invasion, none of those soldiers in Poland experienced real combat. Against Finland, most of the Soviet soldiers, even veterans of the Polish occupation, were relatively recent conscripts, drafted into the Soviet army and given little training before being thrust into combat. Worse, they weren't prepared for the winter weather in Finland, where daytime temperatures could reach 45 degrees below zero. On the other hand, Finnish troops were primarily long-service veterans, well-trained for winter warfare, outfitted with camouflaged white snowsuits, many equipped with skis, and perhaps as important, they were fighting for their home, their families, their country. Against them, the rank-and-file Red Army had no clue why they were fighting. As in Finland in 1939, the Russian Army today is invading a country during the winter using recently conscripted troops who were ill-prepared for an all-out invasion of a well-defended enemy's homeland. The failure to invade Finland using experienced troops, properly dressed and equipped for a winter war, cost the Russians thousands of unnecessary casualties and dragged the war on for more than 3 months, a war the Soviets planned to win in less than 3 weeks. And now it seems to be happening again. Fast forward 83 years. Reports from Ukraine suggest that the Russian army's advance has stalled out again. Why? In yet another winter invasion, because it's still very much winter in Ukraine. An army of mostly recent conscripts given brief training before being thrust into combat has underperformed in ways not anticipated by the Kremlin leaders. The lesson in Ukraine should have been learned in Finland in 1939. On average, Ukrainian soldiers are more experienced and better prepared for the weather. And again, as in Finland, they're fighting for their homes, their families, their nation. Those factors there are very strong force multipliers. The other main lesson from history that the Red Army is ignoring in Ukraine at this point is the division of force. 2,000 years ago, the legendary Chinese master of war, Sun Tzu, wrote, "We can form a single united body, while the enemy must split up into fractions. Hence, there will be a whole pitted against separate parts of a whole." And this is another lesson that the Russians should have learned in Finland in 39. There, again, they divided their forces between the main invasion and the sideshow invasion of central and northern Finland. Outnumbering the Finns, they remained too weak to win anywhere. It took a second invasion of the Karelian Isthmus on top of the first failing invasion, a new assault with a fresh army that finally drove Finland to the negotiating tables more than 3 months after the invasion. In addition to Sun Tzu and von Clausewitz, since the Tsarist days, Imperial, Soviet, and Russian military academies have taught the precepts of military strategist American Admiral Alfred Thayer Mahon. And it was Mahon who warned against the folly of dividing the battle fleet and, by extension, any army assault force. Mahon's books remain required reading for the Russian officer candidates, and yet in its desire to quickly overwhelm Ukraine, Russia divided its invasion force into four separate attack forces. One force is attacking from the northwest out of the Russian puppet state of Belarus. Another is attacking from the northeast along the Russian-Belarusian border. And the third force is attacking due west from the heartland of Russia. The final force is attacking from the south, from Crimea, which Russia took from Ukraine in 2014. To the uninitiated, this might seem like a sound strategy. Everywhere that Ukraine looks, its borders are under attack. However, by mounting four attacks, the Russian army also has to have four air forces to clear their paths, as well as four logistic trains to keep the troops supplied with fuel, bullets, bombs, food, water, repair teams, and medical units. All the while, Ukraine has the long-known benefit of good interior lines. It's far easier for them to move troops and support forces from one attack front to the other using the roads and the railways under their control. The bottom line, the Russian army should know better, and maybe it does, but the shots are being called by the Kremlin. by leaders who have little practical experience with war at a strategic level. Eventually, if Russia is willing to absorb the casualties, they can keep pouring in ill-trained, ill-equipped troops in penny packet formations and eventually wear down the Ukrainians, just as they did Finland in 39. But what could have been a lightning campaign and should have been a lightning campaign, one would think, with the not reported but the reputed readiness levels of the Russian military, this thing should have been over by now. Winston Churchill once said, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Obviously, he wasn't a Russian. And this is the way I'm leaning. The book on Vladimir Putin, and I'm inclined to agree with it. The guy was a career Russian KGB dude, okay? That was his life. His lifeblood was KGB. And he was KGB during the height of the Cold War. I think in many ways, he would like to see a reunification of the Soviet Union. I think he would like to see a rebuilding of the Soviet Union and to occupy the territories it did, you know, during that time when he was in the KGB. I don't think that's going to happen. In 1978, I think, 1979, somewhere around in there, the Russians invaded Afghanistan. And they were there for 20 years. And they were bled white in Afghanistan. They were drained. They left. It was their, I don't want to say it was their Vietnam because that's apples and oranges, but it was a long-term military engagement to which there was no true beneficial outcome for the Russians beyond leaving. And it reached a point where, you know, the losses dictated that they had to go, and they did. And then what happened? We went there for 20 years. And then what happened? Yeah, Big Joey gave everything back to the Afghans. Gave it back to the Taliban. Everything. The SAMs, the Jeeps, the trucks, the M4s, the 50 calibers, the grenade launchers, the missile launchers, the Stingers, the helicopter. He gave it all to them. Okay, all the hardware, $80 billion damn dollars worth of hardware left there. And you know what those guys did with it? They offloaded that crap to the Russians and the Chinese just as quick as they could. And those dudes are having a field day looking at our ordnance and our hardware and figuring out ways to defeat it, to improve their own, and to find the means to which that they can defeat ours. And Joe Biden will look you dead in the eye and say that that was, you know, the most orderly, decent, well-planned retreat since Moses took the people across the Red Sea. That's what he's going to tell you. When the truth is, there are probably close to 1,000 Americans who were left behind that don't want to be there, regardless what the White House tells you. They don't want to be there because they know the time has come when they're going to be raped, they're going to be ransomed, they're going to be tortured, they're going to be burned alive, they're going to be pulled apart by tractors, they're going to be immolated, they're going to be thrown off buildings, with whatever sick, cruel things that the Taliban can do they're going to do to these people. All in the name of tweaking that idiot Joe Biden's nose because of his weakness. Oh, it's 8 o'clock. We're going to take a little break. We'll come back and we'll have a little bit more about the year in review. Hopefully, I guess these will be probably some of the things that happened that Joe will want to talk about this evening in his State of the Union address. God almighty. We'll be back after this. Maybe.
Get to her. blame everything. Man, that fat lady sure could sing. Take the darn house and I wish you luck. There's a Hooter girl waiting in the pickup truck. About a 38D and about a 38IQ. And if you try to save this marriage again, I kill you. If you try to save this marriage again, I kill you.
Tim Wilson, the late, great Tim Wilson with "If You Try to Save This Marriage Again, I'll Kill You." James Bostic back. Well, okay, the Stooge is coming up here in a little bit. Big Joey, the doddering old fool. The reviews are in for Joe Biden's first year in office, and they are not pretty. From the crisis at our southern border to a depleted economy to an embarrassing performance on the world stage, the Biden-Harris administration's time in office has been a disaster of epic proportions. Here's a look at some of the most noteworthy failures. The border crisis first. A record number of immigrants surged to the southern border under Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's watch. What started out as a border crisis quickly turned into a national security, health, and humanitarian crisis, while the Biden administration buried their collective heads in the sand. In March of 2021, Biden tried to write off the influx of migrants at the border as a seasonal event, but nearly a year into, over a year into his administration, really, the numbers proved him dead wrong. The chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan left 13 American service members dead and thousands of citizens and allies stranded behind enemy lines. Democrats, former Obama administration officials, and U.S. allies criticized Biden's botched withdrawal as a moral and operational failure. Meanwhile, Biden's incompetence shined further after claiming a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan was not inevitable following the withdrawal of U.S. troops. We won't see helicopters on the rooftops of embassies like we did in Vietnam, is what he promised. Inflation rose to a 40-year high, and it is still shooting up. Thanks to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris's reckless economic policies, prices have skyrocketed on everything from food to energy to used cars to clothing, leaving hardworking Americans to foot the bill. Meanwhile, the Biden administration dismissed the inflation as being temporary, and Democrats ignored their constituents' inflation fears while forging ahead with their new big spending agenda. Americans also faced pain at the pump. As gas prices hit a 7-year high in some parts of the country, such as Los Angeles, drivers are paying $4.42 a gallon, the highest in nearly a decade. But instead of tackling the issue head on, the Biden-Harris administration decided to throw up their hands and point fingers at OPEC. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm even laughed out loud when asked about the White House's plan to lower gas prices and increase U.S. oil production. A collapsing legislative agenda. Senate Democrats abandoned Joe Biden's Build Back Better reconciliation package after failing to come to an agreement within their own caucus. Then Senator Schumer forced vulnerable Democrats to walk the plank on the filibuster for their already doomed election takeover bill. And finally, failure to shut down the virus. In October 2020, Joe Biden told us he would shut down the virus. Then in July 2021, he declared independence from COVID-19 and celebrated what he deemed to be an heroic vaccination campaign. 5 months later, as COVID continued to surge, Biden put the responsibility of addressing COVID on state lawmakers, saying there is no federal solution. October 2020, Joe says, we're going to shut down the virus. 5 months later, he says, there is no federal solution. In the meantime, Americans continue to face a record number of new COVID cases and testing shortage across the country. There have been more COVID cases and more fatalities from COVID in Joe Biden's first year in office than there was during the first year of the pandemic under Donald Trump. And that's with these dubious vaccines. Bottom line, just like all of us, you're going to agree with me when I say that more than a third of the country, more than a third of the country, gave Joe Biden an F for his first year in office, and for good reason. These past 12, 13, 14 months have been defined by one crisis after another, thanks to their failed leadership. What is he going to talk about tonight? What's he going to talk about? I mean, he's in China's hip pocket. And we're going to get back. You know, I tell you, we're going to have to get back to it, and I guess maybe we will on Thursday a little bit. It depends on what's going on with the war. But we need to stay focused on red-handed, because the biggest threats to the United States aren't in Ukraine. They're not in Russia. They're in China, and they're here amongst us, looking for all the world like good, decent, patriotic Americans, and they are not. Everybody makes noise, and you hear it on a lot of talk. I do listen to a lot of radio. I listen to a lot of talk radio. And, you know, you hear it everywhere. November's coming. You know, it's like one of the bumpers when they end a segment. Hang tight, America. November is coming. And all, you know, okay, that's great. And that's awesome. And by the way, I saw where another Democrat representative is saying, you know, I think it's a good time for me to spend time with my family, so I'm peacing out. That makes 30 Democrats from either the Senate or the House of Representatives that have said, screw you guys, I'm leaving. And that's what they've done. Now, there is enough depth in the roster, I'm sure, that there will be Democrat candidates, you know, to take the place of these guys that are stepping down and bugging out. But that doesn't mean anything. Okay? It's safe to assume that the lion's share of these men and women that are going to spend time with their family that they've missed so much. Saw the handwriting on the wall. That's why they're getting the hell out of there. And probably has to do a lot of their vote record and what positions they supported. Well, okay. So they're going to find candidates to replace them. But these candidates, you know, they probably have seen the writing on the wall too, and they're saying to themselves, well, hell, if John's getting out after 35 years, you know, what kind of chance do I stand of even getting in? And that kind of defeatism is contagious. And like contagion, it will spread quickly. And that is a gratifying thing. That is a good thing. However, my question to you is this. If the Republican politicians and the Republican leadership that we vote in 2022, to replace these Democrats, aren't any different in their motivations, in their true ideologies, then what have we done? What have we done? We're going to have a whole bunch of rhinos trying to implement watered-down versions, diluted versions, of these kooky left-wing policies. And that's a very real possibility. It's not just Democrats that are crooks. It's not just Democrats that are greedy, that can be bought off. Isn't that right, Mitch? Yeah, baby. Isn't that right, Paul Ryan? Isn't that right, John Boehner? Isn't that right, Tim Hutchinson? Isn't that right, Ed Royce? Isn't that right, former Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott? Senator Norman Coleman? Senator John Lieberman? The list goes on and on. Those are all Republicans I'm talking about. Peach Watcher talks about him in the book, red-handed. It's all right there. It's all open source. These guys are in the pay of the Chinese Communist government. So that's great. These Democrats are bugging out. Swell. They got their money. They've made their pile. And now they're going to go blow it. But if we put Republicans in those seats that aren't any different fundamentally from what just got tossed out, where are we? We are back to the importance, the mission critical, the existential importance of an informed and disseminating electorate, aren't we? Because that's the only ticket out of this mess, man. An informed and disseminating electorate. And when they find out that these people whom they have elected to represent their interests are not doing so, then they must be swift and they must be merciless and they must be ruthless in weeding these people out. The only way. Short of the hay rakes, pitchforks, and torches. This is the only way. Through the electorate. It's 8:21. I'm about out of gas. I want to get ready for this thing. I know you guys do too. Thank you so much for the opportunity to hang out with you and talk about things. We will be here Thursday. This Thursday. Most of you know, if you've been following my saga, been in the school business for a long time and getting ready to step out into a teaching position. But in order to do that, certain examinations that I've got to negotiate successfully and pass, and I'm in the process of doing that and taking a class geared for just that sort of thing. And sadly, it meets every other Thursday. So when I'm not taking practice tests, out the wazoo. I'm doing that. But this Thursday is not a class night, so I'll be back with you, and we will delve deeper into this. Get some popcorn. Get comfortable. I just got a feeling this is going to be, and I'll tell you something else. I don't think it's going to be very long. I really don't. I don't think this is going to be a very long speech at all. And I'm wondering what time he went to bed so that he would be ready at 9 o'clock to do this. Because I guarantee you, they put his ass down probably about 2 or 3. Nice long sleep, get him up about 6:37, a light dinner, go over everything, shoot his ass up with whatever nootropic cocktail they have that's designed to help him maintain that tenuous grip on lucidity that he has, and send him out there and see what happens. It is an embarrassment for the country. Really, as crass and as boorish and as classless as people think Donald Trump is, he never would have brought us here. Oh, that's all the time we got, man. I'm going to get out of here. Thank you once again for hanging out and talking about stuff. Sundays, 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Mojo 50 Radio. You can catch us with a recorded version of the program. Tuesdays, 7 to 9, 8:30, 9-ish. We're kind of flexible on that. And then every other Thursday, and maybe periodically just for kicks, a show on a Friday or a Saturday when I'm just, you know, bored and don't have anything else to do. Thank you for the opportunity. When we get out of here, we will be back Thursday, 7 p.m., taking a look at things as we do through a conservative perspective. In the meantime, God bless you. God bless America. We'll see you then. You guys take good care.